Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week, we pick a new history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week, I'm very pleased to say we have Charles King on the show, and we'll be talking about his book, The Ghost of Freedom, A History of the Caucasus. There are two things you can say about the Caucasus. First is that they are very complicated. As you probably know, there are many different kinds of people that live there. There are the Azerbaijanis and the Georgians and the Armenians and the Abkhazians and the Ossetians and the Chechens and the various folks who live in Dagestan and the Circassians and God knows what else. They practice many religions. They speak many languages. So all of this adds up to a considerable degree of complexity. The second thing we can say about the Caucasus is that they kind of punch above their weight in terms of importance. Since the Caucasus stand at the union of three early modern and modern empires, those being the Persian, the Russian, and the Turkish, they have always been an extremely important, a strategically important place. And they are today, particularly as regards security issues that we're all interested in here in the United States and perhaps in the Western world. So it's with this background in mind that I can highly recommend to you this book by Charles King, The Ghost of Freedom. I had a terrific time talking to Charles today about the Caucasus. Nobody knows more about it than he. I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Charles.
Hello.
How are you today?
I'm good. Thanks very much.
You certainly sound
great. Thanks for having me on the show.
That's my pleasure. How is the weather? You're in D.C., is that right?
That's right. I'm here in D.C. in the Georgetown neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
It's heading back up into the 50s. You know, we're just digging out from this incredible snow dump, and there are still gigantic piles of snow all around the place.
Not incredible by our measure here in Iowa. I should tell our listeners that we are lucky to have Charles King on the show, and he is not snowbound, but he is very busy writing books. He's written a lot of books, and the most recent one, I think it's the most recent one. Is it the most recent one, Charles?
There's actually one out now beyond it, but it's a political science book, so
okay.
It doesn't count.
All right. Well, anyway, today we're going to be talking about what I guess isn't his most recent book. It's called The Ghost of Freedom, and it's a history of the Caucasus region, for those of you who know, which is called The Ghost of Freedom, A History of the Caucasus. And as you know, if you listen to this show, I read these books, and this one is terrific because it takes something which is really extraordinarily complex. It's pretty mind-bogglingly complicated, the Caucasus. And Charles manages to tell, in a very eloquent way, a pretty compelling and easy-to-understand story about it. So it's a wonderful book in the sense that it reduces the natural complexity of the place to a level that someone like me, who's not an expert on the Caucasus, I don't really know much about it, can understand. Also, as you probably know, this is an incredibly important part of the world right now. It doesn't make the news very much, but it is up there with, I guess, just a few places, and you know, ones in the Middle East, and perhaps a couple places in China. As places that the United States really needs to watch very, very closely. A lot is going on there, and a lot is at stake for American power and Western power in general. And I'm sure Charles will talk about that. So this book is for the New York Times reading crowd or the London Times reading crowd, something that I think that it would pay you to pick up so that you can see, as they say on CNN or something, what's behind the headlines. And there is a lot behind the headlines. It's a very rich story. So go out there and buy the book. But Charles, let's begin the interview in our traditional way by you telling us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a professor at Georgetown University. I teach in a place called the School of Foreign Service, which is, despite its name, not a place that's intended only to train U.S. Foreign Service officers or CIA operatives. There may or may not be some of my former students in those organizations. I don't know. But it is a School of International Affairs, a sort of broad-based undergraduate and master's level curricula in international affairs. I also teach in the government department at Georgetown. So by training, I guess I'm a political scientist by vocation and by passion, much more of a modern and contemporary historian. I'm from Arkansas originally. I grew up in Arkansas on a cattle farm. And then went to the University of Arkansas, where I was a philosophy major. My father always used to ask me, or used to tell me I should practice saying, "Would you like fries with that?" because I would need that to apply my philosophy degree. Graduated as a philosophy major, and then did kind of Russian studies on the side as a kind of minor, and then went off to Oxford University. And, you know, how are you going to keep them down on the farm? Went off to Oxford and studied for a master's degree and a doctorate in Russian East European studies, and then in politics, the doctorate in politics. And been kind of engaged with Russia and Eastern Europe ever since. I think originally the idea was, you know, how could I be as weird as possible coming from a farm in Arkansas? Yeah. And in the 1980s, you got to be weird, you know, either by joining a punk band or studying Russian, studying the communists. And I chose the latter.
I did both those things in the 80s.
we will forget some of the things, yes. The hairstyles, the members only jackets, and we'll put that aside.
I don't want to go back there. Some pictures of me in skinny ties, but I'm not going to show them to anyone. I promise.
They're back in. Oh, so
Jesus,
take them out.
That's terrible. So, but I have a sort of silly question for you, and I think those people from the United States who listen to the show will understand this. I lived in Arkansas for a while, as I told you. Where's the Arkansas accent? What happened to it?
You know, I think I lived in Britain for 6 years, and I think it just got somehow washed out. There are my wife will tell me, and in fact, she wants it to come back. She finds it very charming, but there are a few things that a few areas in which it still comes out. One, if I've had a bit to drink or I'm very tired, it will come out. But also, my short E's and my short I's get mixed up a lot. So, you know, get becomes get. And so on, and that I can't control, nor do I try to control.
Well, for those of you who don't know, you can just listen to Bill Clinton, because not only does he have one, he cultivates it.
It's exactly right.
Tool for him. It makes him sound real folksy, even though he's not.
I mean, Hillary Clinton used to have one. She had one when she was First Lady of Arkansas, but then she became very Chicago again once she left.
Well, she was always kind of well-heeled.
That's true. And now I guess very sort of Chippewa, New York.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. She's probably drinking Pimm's or something. I don't know what she drinks. But, so anyway, how did you come to write this book?
Well, I had I have a tendency, I think, to write books about places that people say can't have histories. My first book was really a version of my doctoral dissertation. It was about sort of the controversy surrounding this strange and interesting little country called Moldova, which is right on the border between Romania and Ukraine, and has passed back and forth over the centuries between Ottoman control, Romanian control, Russian control, Soviet control, and so on. And the core issue in that country was and still is politically, are the Moldovans a nation or not? Do they constitute a separate kind of national group? Some say they do. Others say they're just Romanians by a different name. And the book was really an attempt to kind of write a history of a nation that many Romanian nationalists contend just doesn't exist at all. The next book I did, called The Black Sea, A History, was to try to write the history of a body of water that told its story in ways other than just, you know, derring do on the high seas, but really was trying to look at the history of the Black Sea and the Black Sea littoral as a region. People have done that for the Mediterranean before. They've done it for the Atlantic before. And now I was trying to do it for this bit of Eastern Europe, a part of the world where people often think the only things that really have histories are ethnically defined nations. Mm-hmm. You know, the history of the Bulgarians, of the Ukrainians, of the Romanians. And I wanted to break that down and use the sea as a lever against that. Mm-hmm. And so then from kind of the water, I ended up going to the mountains. The Caucasus is a region of, as you were saying, you know, incredible religious, linguistic, ethnic diversity, scores and scores of distinct ethnic groups, many of them speaking mutually unintelligible languages from completely separate language families. It's a place where empires have met, the Russian, the Persian, the Ottoman, the Soviet. It's a place where religions have met, Orthodox Christianity, the Armenian Apostolic tradition, Islam in both its Sunni and Shia variants. And the history writing about the Caucasus has traditionally taken one of two forms. Either it's a history of Russian imperial conquest and, Russian soldiers being killed in upland defiles by fanatical Muslims, or it's really the history of ancient nations and their translation into modern nation states, the history of the Georgian people, the history of the Armenian people, and so on. And I really wanted to write a history that was different from either of those two traditions, and again, to take geography seriously and to talk about the ways in which the mountains have been not so much a barrier to the interaction of peoples and cultures, but have in fact been the very landscape on which those interactions have taken place.
Mm-hmm. Well, I can, if I might just take a moment to offend all of my colleagues, I can say that I applaud you for trying to write what I would call transnational history. But it's also, I think it's the kind of thing that would be very extraordinarily difficult in any history program or history department, because we are divided nationally. So if you came to your advisor or someone came to me and said, yes, I want to write a history of the Caspian Sea, I'd say, well, you can do that, and then you'll need to learn a phrase. Fries with that, because
you like fries with that. Yeah,
exactly. Because history departments, they're divided up nationally, and it's very difficult to work in the spaces in between. I know a couple of people who have done it. Actually, one of them's right in your area, and she teaches at where does she teach? At Maryland. Where? Darn it, if I can remember. I think she teaches at Baltimore, but at University of Maryland, Baltimore, I think, and she's managed to do it. There are a couple of other people maybe who've managed to
do it. Oh, is that Kate Brown?
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Kate Brown is who I'm thinking
of.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I think she's
managed to work in space. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I think you have to sort of define yourself given the realities or the sociology of the history profession, and as you say, the way departments are divided by chronology and by culture in a way, because I think historians kind of believe that chronology and culture just matter, and that's a completely honorable thing to believe. Mm-hmm. I think so. Given realities, I think people have to define themselves as being in some kind of camp. You're a Russianist or East Europeanist, yeah. You're a Germanist or whatever. But within that, I think there's a lot of scope, even at the doctoral level, for people to be very creative. I have a doctoral student, I'm actually on his committee, even though he's in the history department, who's doing work on the history of disease around the Black Sea, a fundamentally transnational issue and a very sexy topic. But I think he would define himself as a Russianist if he were going on the job market. And he's worked in Ukrainian, Russian, Ottoman archives, which I think you have to do for that kind of subject.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. No, I mean, people do it more and more. I think the Americanists have been very successful in terms of carving out a kind of international history that can lead to employment, that being the Atlantic world. We talked about that on this show. There's some thematic histories, the history of genocide, for example. We had a fellow on last week or 2 weeks ago who does that. But it's really kind of sadly the case that we are in history departments still divided up into national sections, which isn't to say that sort of some fundamental knowledge of some nation isn't a very, very good thing to have in your pocket. But I don't know. I find myself increasingly interested in what I would call transnational history, sort of moving past the nation. But, nations really matter a lot. I guess that sounds really banal, doesn't it? But in any event, why don't we?
Well, they do. I mean, I think sort of knowledge has to reside somewhere, right? And might as well reside in a belief in the causal power of time and place. I think, political scientists, social scientists would say, so power of time and place is an imperial question. That is, they ought to ask whether and how time and place actually matter. Whereas I think historians could take it as a given. But I think the field, there's fields in the history of subfields within Russian Indian history now that are so dynamic that are transnational. Late imperial Russian history is a magnificent field. Now Soviet cultural history has long been a very interesting field. So I think you can be in. certainly within those boundaries.
Yeah, no, it happens. While you mentioned place, I was very interested in the attention you pay to geography. Maybe we could actually start a discussion of the book with geography, because geography was such an important part of the history of the Caucasus. It's an old story, and you begin it from the beginning. Why don't you tell us about what the Caucasus is like geographically and why it is like that?
Well, the mountains really get all the attention, as perhaps they should. The Caucasus mountain range extends about 700 miles, though, from really one peninsula to the next, from a place called the Pam Peninsula up in the northwest, which is right at the intersection or near the intersection of Russia and Ukraine, edge of the Black Sea, all the way down in the southeast to a peninsula called the Absheron Peninsula that juts out into the Caspian Sea. And along this diagonal of incredible mountains, gorgeous mountainous terrain. You have some of the highest mountains in Europe, if you think of that part of the world as still being in Europe. Mount Elbrus, for example, the tallest peak geographically in Europe, is located in the Caucasus, and there are plenty of others, especially this district called the Central Range, right in the middle of a 700-mile long mountain chain. And, you know, you have some sort of great mountaineering stories and so forth from the history of alpinism that take place in the Caucasus. But the region itself, geographically, very, very diverse. On the northern slopes, you have the beginning of the Eurasian steppe, flatlands, prairie, traditionally nomadic herders living there, of course, that ended about 200 years ago. And then on the southern slope, you have extremely lush river valleys. You have arid steppe in the extreme southeast in the southern part of what is now Azerbaijan. You have denuded hills and rocky mountains in upland Armenia, also in the south of the main vein of the Caucasus. So, even though it's always described as this rugged and mountainous land, very few people actually live at altitude, and it is it's a part of the world where I think cultures, civilizations, and now modern politics takes place in those rivers and lowlands.
Mm-hmm. I see. So if somebody asks you the following question, is there a place in the United States or a place in the world that people are very familiar with? I don't know, Switzerland or something, that would remind one, because most people have not been to the Caucasus Mountains.
Sure. I mean, certainly if you're in the Caucasus uplands, it looks very much like the Swiss, even though the Caucasus Mountains are taller than the Alps. But, certainly granite, outcroppings covered in snow, and pine forests a bit lower down. Uh-huh. But again, if you're, parts of it will also look like the Great Plains of the American Midwest. Mm-hmm. Other parts of it will look like parts of Florida, mm-hmm. very, very lush. So it's an area in which the cultural diversity is mapped on top of, mm-hmm. And perhaps results in a real geographical diversity as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's an insightful point. It's one I talk a little bit about in the write up to this particular interview. So who lives there, and how did they get there? That's a ridiculous question, I suppose, but try to answer it as best you can.
No, not at all. I mean, if I were giving this as a sort of visual lecture rather than a video show, I would have a map that I always put up at the beginning of the lecture that is like a kind of Rorschach test, I guess. But it's an ethnic map, the Caucasus, and it looks like has just splattered paint all over the map, and or we'll call it a Jackson Pollock, map of the Caucasus that is meant to show us the incredible diversity of linguistic and cultural ethnic groups who live in the region. And it certainly is incredibly diverse. You have representatives of virtually every major Eurasian European language family, from the speakers of an Indo-European language, the Armenians, who live principally in the South Caucasus, in the country of Armenia, the independent country of Armenia. You have speakers of Turkic languages, for example, the inhabitants of Azerbaijan, Armenia's neighbors just to the east. You have speakers of languages that are related to Persian, also an Indo-European language, the Ossetians of the North Caucasus and the South Caucasus, were much in the news in the summer of 2008 because of the Russia-Georgia war, which was over a piece of territory called South Ossetia. And then you have, beyond that, a whole range of linguistic and ethnic groups who speak languages that have no relation really to anything else on the planet. So-called Circassian ethnic groups who live in the northwest part of the Caucasus, speaking of their own separate language unrelated to anything around it. Well, I take that back. It's related to Abkhaz, but that doesn't really help us very much.
No, it does.
Georgians, in the independent country of Georgia, who speak their own ancient language with, like the Armenians, their own ancient alphabet, but related to nothing else around it. Well, I should say it's related to Svan and Laz and Mingrelian, but that doesn't help us very much. And then in this mountainous territory up in the northeastern Caucasus, it's called Dagestan, a name which from the Turkic word Dag simply means mountain or mount the literally mountainous land or the highlands of the Caucasus. Over 100 ethnic groups in that region, 34 principal ethnic groups speaking mutually unintelligible languages. I mean, it's an incredibly diverse part of the world. I would say, though, that there are lots of other parts of the world that are just as ethnically and linguistically diverse, and it's not always mountains that are like that. I mean, the Eurasian steppe before the age of modern empires and sedentary populations was also amazingly ethnically diverse, even though the ethnic groups tended to be on the move a lot as nomadic populations, or the American Great Plains before white settlement, incredibly diverse. So, you know, we often have this idea that mountains be ethnic diversity, and cliches about the Caucasus is, every mountain, every valley has its own language or ethnic group, which is, of course, an overstatement. But flatlands can be just as diverse, just as diverse as well.
I see. So we have all these ethnic groups. One of the themes that you draw out in an attempt to unify or provide a unified story for the Caucasus is the interaction between these many different peoples and specifically three empires. Why don't we talk a little bit about them? Because it is in a relatively peculiar place, imperially speaking.
That's right. It is a place that, for the last half millennium or so has been at the meeting place of different political, social, economic, strategic systems. The Russian Empire conquered the Caucasus in a whole series of diplomatic moves and outright wars from the beginning of the 19th century up to roughly the 1860s. But before that, the area had sort of gone back and forth, had been a point of contention between the Ottoman Turks on one side, who exercised some religious influence and some economic influence on the western bit of the Caucasus, the Persians, who exercised some religious and economic, to a degree strategic influence on the eastern Caucasus, particularly the southeast, but the east in general. And then from the 18th century forward, culminating in these series of diplomatic moves and wars of the early 19th century, the Russian Empire coming down from the north and gradually exerting power over the indigenous political elites that they found there in the mountains. The Russian conquest, though, proceeded in a couple of different ways, depending on kind of what the Russians found when they got there. In some places, political elites, indigenous native political elites, were extremely well established. There were ancient princely families or ancient royal families in parts of the Circassian lands in the north, in Georgia, in parts of Armenia. And it was possible for the Russians simply to absorb those native elites into the Russian imperial system. The Russians were very, very good, very adept, I should say, much more than the British or the French in their overseas empires in absorbing indigenous elites into their imperial system. The Brits, sort of wanted to conquer them. The Russians wanted to make them nobles. And so that was a kind of one kind of pattern, I guess. In other areas where there were few local indigenous elites, or where those elites were very, very divided among themselves, Russia, in some instances, sort of invented local elites to rule over the newly conquered territory, sort of taking a local chieftain and raising him up to the level of a prince or a khan or whatever local title might have been used. So in some ways, the patterns of conquest were very, very different depending on which bit of the Caucasus the Russians encountered. And that set up, I think, a set of strategic problems for the Russian Empire over the course of the 19th century.
How did the just a question, I guess. Did the Ottomans and the Persians also, this would be the Safavids, did they have any success in integrating these local elites? I mean, I don't really know.
Sure. I mean, depending on the period, particularly in the South Caucasus, local elites were very much a part of either the Persian administrative political system, or to a lesser degree, the Ottoman political administrative system. I say in the Ottoman case a lesser degree because the areas of the Caucasus in which the Ottomans actually did exert influence, in those areas that influence was by and large exerted through a middleman group, and that was a group known as the Crimean Tatars, the rulers of that little geographical appendage that sticks out into the Black Sea from the northern coast, the Crimea area. In the Persian case, though, again, depending on the period, you have Georgian princes serving the Persian Shah. You have Georgian princes dying in Persia's wars in Afghanistan. Story Georgians often now tell themselves is of this ancient Christian kingdom, and most Georgians are traditionally Orthodox by religion, this ancient Christian kingdom that has forever fought against the nefarious Muslim. That's, of course, not true to historical fact, because you had plenty of Georgians in the service to nominally Shia ruler in Persia for centuries. Mm-hmm. Kind of example of this sort of mixing of cultures and religions.
Is there any particular succession or order in the way in which these three empires interacted? I know that the Russians had reasonably cordial relations with the Persians for a long time, but they fought a whole series of wars over the Caucasus with the Ottomans, who I don't know what it is about Ottoman history, but it's a little bit like in Western European history, the bourgeoisie is always rising, but in history, the Ottomans are always falling. I think that violates like the first law of thermodynamics or something. But aren't they always falling? Am I wrong about that?
That is true. I mean, if you go back to the middle of the 16th century, I guess things were pretty good for the Ottomans. But yeah, the European story about the Ottomans from roughly 1550 on is a story of decline. Again, I'm not sure that that's exactly true to reality, but that's the European version of events. I think what happens in the Caucasus by the late 18th century and beginning of the 19th century is that Russia increasingly gets pulled into a series of conflicts on what is, by that stage, Russia's own southern border. To a degree, Russia under Peter the Great, and then more importantly under Catherine the Great at the end of the 18th century, does have this strategic vision for itself and for its south. It wants to move against an Ottoman sultan that appears increasingly weak. Ideally, it wants to gain complete control of the Black Sea and the riches that the sea and its coastline provide, and perhaps in the grandest Russian vision, to take control of Constantinople, put a Russian prince on the throne there, and create a revived Byzantine Orthodox Empire and drive the infidel Muslim Turk out. Those strategic visions work in the Caucasus as well, and particularly under Catherine, Russia does begin to develop this almost manifest destiny in the Caucasus region. But I think even more important than that is the degree to which the empire gets pulled into the local struggles and security problems of this borderland. In the 1790s, the city of Tiflis, or what we now call Tbilisi, the capital of Georgia, is sacked by the Persians. A good part for the city destroyed. And the Georgians, looking for a protector against the Persians, look naturally to the north, to this Orthodox Christian monarch on the throne of a power that is clearly rising to their north, and seek protection against the Persians. Now, if it had been two centuries earlier, the Georgians might be seeking protection from the Persians against the Ottomans, but times had changed. And Russia is kind of drawn in to being the protector of these Orthodox Christians on the border of an Islamic empire. And that also tends to fit at the time with certain strategic visions that many Russian political elites had at the time. Another example of the way in which Russia's sort of drawn into these conflicts almost willy-nilly goes back to the idea of Russia's sort of creating its own elites on the ground that I mentioned earlier. This is very much the case in parts of the North Caucasus, in the area of what we now call Chechnya and the area of Dagestan that I mentioned earlier, where central structure, when the Russians first arrive, is pretty flat. There are tribal chieftains, there are individual villages and clusters of villages that band together as a kind of political unit. But there's no overarching king, no overarching prince or khan. The Russians come in and realize that the way that you get influence in these societies that are very, very flat and you might say democratic with a small d, is by creating a system of notables and elites and then imbuing them with the sort of stamp of imperial authority. Mm-hmm. The problem with that strategy is that there were always people around willing to contest that, to say that in fact those elites are simply stooges of the Russians or stooges of those infidel Christians, and by the 1820s and 1830s you begin to get these uprisings in Chechnya and Dagestan against local elites who are cooperating with the Russians. The most famous of those, and it goes on for about 30 years, is a rebellion led by a man named Shamil, who is probably the most famous Highland leader in the Caucasus ever. He's the equivalent of Sitting Bull or Geronimo in American Western history. Mm-hmm. Legendary kind of figure. And he leads an uprising, not so much against the Russians, but against all of these local elites who have been created by the Russians and are cooperating with them. So again, there are a whole series of stories going on, none of which I think is really about a nation's claim to greatness or the ancient roots of one or another culture, the normal stories that people in the Caucasus sometimes tell themselves now. But they're really a story of strategic bargains made and broken, and the interests of empires and locals in how they respond to the designs of imperial sovereigns from beyond the Caucasus itself.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a little bit about something. I've spent some time – I've actually never been to the Caucasus, but I spend a lot of time in Russia. And one of the things I know from reading Russian literature and talking to Russians and things like this is there really is an important place in the Russian mind for the Caucasus. I mean, we think about and talk about Orientalism in Western and Central Europe, but Russia's Orientalism really comes from Central Asia and from the Caucasus. An outstanding example of the Central Asian influence is the fact that Russians still hang carpets on their walls. And this comes right from Central Asia. And I do wonder I think the listeners might be familiar with that and the fact there was an early engagement in Russian literature, Russian Romantic literature of the Caucasus. But did it work the other way around? What influence did Russian culture have on these indigenous, if you want to use that term, ethnic groups and cultures? This is something we don't hear much about.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're exactly right that this was a two-way street. I mean, over the course of the 19th century in particular, Russians came to imagine the Caucasus as theirs, as their territory once it was completely conquered. You see, echoes of that even in the Georgia-Russia War of 2008 and the way in which that was portrayed in the Russian media. But they also begin to imagine themselves as in part Caucasian in a regional sense. But, you know, hanging carp is on the wall is a good example of that. Drinking Armenian brandy, going to a Georgian restaurant, of Georgian restaurants in Moscow. And the Georgian food is our food. And then wearing, the Cherkesska, that thing that we now think of as a kind of Cossack garment, that long male tunic, with some slots on the chest that we think looks typically Russian. That's, of course, a Caucasus garment. It's called a Cherkesska from the word Cherkess or Circassian, named after the ethnic group of the Northwest Caucasus. So, but that process was also working in the opposite direction, so that people in the Caucasus came to think of themselves as not necessarily Russian in a kind of ethnic sense, but looked to Russia and thought of Russia as a kind of natural pole of elites and cultural belonging and so forth. The expansion of Russian as a kind of lingua franca across the Caucasus is only about 200 years old, only in historical terms, only about 200 years old. Before then, lingua franca was either a version of Turkish for much of the Caucasus, or even Arabic in parts of Dagestan, where that was both an administrative language as well as a religious language. And so, Russia's cultural influence, the Soviet cultural influence over the course of the 20th century, absolutely profound, completely reshaped these societies. The interesting thing over the last 20 years, as at least the South Caucasus, Georgia, Armenia, Azerbaijan have been independent from Russia, of course, no longer part of that old country, the Soviet Union. The interesting thing has been the way in which they've tried to imagine their own history without Russia, to look back to the Middle Ages or look back to the glorious era of Georgian kingdoms of the 1100s and 1200s and see that as the most legitimate history. The 200 years of the Russian Empire, Russian imperial experience in the Caucasus as being somehow forgotten or illegitimate history.
I see. That process is fascinating. It's ongoing in Russia as well, where we see the Russians trying to define themselves outside of things like Ukraine and Belarus and the Caucasus and Central Asia and things like this, trying to write a history that doesn't involve those places. It turns out to be a kind of a tricky thing to do because it often runs up against the facts, which, doesn't deter everyone. It should deter us as professionals, but it doesn't deter everyone. I want to talk a little bit about a couple of special relationships, actually three. And the first is between, at least what I perceive to be special relationships in that kind of airy-fairy way. Americans talk about the special relationship between Russia and Britain, and all my British friends think that it's a load of shite. But the Americans have this thing in their head. So the first one, actually the three of them, and one is Russia and Georgia that I perceive. Another one is between Persia or Iran and Azerbaijan. And then the third and most problematic of them is between Turkey and Armenia. Why don't we start with the third one? Maybe you could just tell us a little bit about that relationship and how it really went horribly sour and what it's like today.
Well, this is sort of much in the news because we're now in the season in which the U.S. Congress every year, every spring, debates whether to pass a joint resolution of Congress recognizing the Armenian genocide of 1915, and all the newspapers, at least here in Washington, are full of news about this now. It's in the run up to April 24th, which is the year in which the date on which the genocide is commemorated each year. The Armenian-Turkish relationship is one of those in which, as you put it, I think exactly rightly, it went sour, which implies that it was much better at one point in time. It was, insofar as Armenians lived for centuries within the Ottoman Empire, really quite successfully. Some of them, moving to the absolute top of the Ottoman imperial system. The Armenians were also always known as the most loyal millet, or the most loyal constituent group or nation within the Ottoman Empire. things began to go very sour at the end of the 19th century for a couple of different reasons. One, as the Ottoman Empire itself was weakening, Russia once again sought to take advantage of that and supported nationalists within the Armenian community, principally in the diaspora or living inside the Russian Empire in what is now the country of Armenia, supporting their territorial claims on the eastern bit of the Ottoman region in eastern Anatolia, where there were large numbers of local Armenians living. You get the rise of bandit groups, you get the rise of guerrilla formations, many of them supported or financed, outfitted by the Russians from the 1880s and 1890s forward. That accelerates over the course of the First World War, when of course the Ottomans and Russia were on different sides of that conflict. Russians invade eastern Anatolia and take control of a good bit of the territory in which, for part of the war, in which local Armenians had been settled for millennia. And the Ottoman response to that is to see the Armenians no longer as the most loyal constituent of the Ottoman state, but rather as a threat to the Ottoman state. And principally in 1915, 1915 is the year in which Armenian intellectuals in Istanbul were, many of them were rounded up and either deported or executed by the Ottoman state. But throughout that 1890s, early 20th century, throughout the period of the First World War, all the way up through the early 1920s, a series of rolling deportations of Armenians from the eastern bit of the empire, on the border between Anatolia, the core constituent of modern Turkey, and the Caucasus. And those deportations lead to hundreds of thousands of deaths. The numbers, I think, will never really be known. Somewhere between 800,000 and 1.5 million Armenians die in that process. For Armenians now, particularly in the Armenian diaspora, this memory of this horrific set of events is the critical traumatic experience of the Armenian nation in the 20th century. For many Turks, they will say, as horrible as these things were, plenty of Muslims died in these conflicts as well, not only in Anatolia, but look at the death of Muslims and the deportation of Muslims from the Balkans, which was one of the things that, in fact, created a modern country that we call Turkey that is in large part a Muslim society. It's those deportees and immigrants who contributed to the creation of the modern Turkish state. So you have, deep divisions to historical memory, all of these issues terribly politicized now. I have no trouble using the term Armenian genocide. I mean, to my mind, by really any standards of genocide today, I think what happened at the end of the 19th century and first two decades of the 20th century should count under that label. But I also realize that there is a great deal of alchemy going on when it comes to how historical memories get interpreted and changed over time. There's not the one answer to this question. And so, when now people ask, was it a genocide? Was it not a genocide? I don't think there's one easy answer to that question. I use the term analytically, but it's terribly politicized as well.
Yeah, if you're going to sit down with an Armenian and a Turk, I think the question of genocide would be what they call in negotiations a non-starter. That would end things
exactly
right there. There would be no more discussion about basically anything. It is fascinating. So in a parallel kind of way, the Russians have fallen out with the Georgians recently, and I know a little bit about this history. They were, to use a colloquial phrase, buddy-buddy for a very long time. And now that too seems to have soured. Maybe you could tell us that story.
Well, exactly right. I mean, it's not comfortable for many Georgians to admit these days, but I think Georgians and Russians were the sort of conquerors of the Caucasus, if you like. Georgians were a part of the Russian imperial system from 1801 forward. The Georgian nobility was absorbed into the Russian system of noble ranks, and Georgians moved to the absolute top of the Russian imperial structure, serving as generals, serving as fighters on the front lines with Caucasus Highlanders and so on. So, and then, of course, Tiflis, the city of Tbilisi, became the Russian imperial center. Throughout the 19th century, the kind of jewel in the crown for the Russians in the South Caucasus. And then, of course, during the Soviet period, Georgians play, I think, a disproportionately powerful role in the even in the Soviet system. Characters like Lavrenty Beria, or of course Joseph Stalin himself, who was who were both Georgians. Were responsible for the way in which the Caucasus was administered during the Soviet era, and I think also at a kind of cultural level, the Georgians became the kind of Sicilians of the Russian and Soviet system. That is, people who are a little bit foreign, but you love them for it. They're the ones who know how to drink well, who know how to eat well, they know how to laugh well, and even though they're not Russians, they're your first cousin in a way, at least in terms of sensibility. But I think there was always a kind of, always a kind of tension there, because there is a cultural divide between these peoples. They're not from the same linguistic background. They are, neighbors, maybe even first cousins, but not really brothers. Even though both are traditionally Orthodox by religion, the Georgians have jealously guarded their own cultural, religious, and historical traditions, have guarded those very, very proudly. Georgia, for example, along with Armenia, were the only two republics in the Soviet Union that had an official language that wasn't Russian. Georgians and Armenians were allowed to keep Georgian and Armenian as their official languages, which is why, even during the Soviet period, rates of absolute assimilation to Russian were relatively low in those places, and why now it's increasingly rare to find any younger people in Georgia in particular who have a very good knowledge of Russian at all. English would now be the second language of choice. And I think then over the last 20 years, a lot of these sort of points of tension became outright points of conflict. Over a couple of territorial issues, a place called South Ossetia and a place called Abkhazia in Georgia, which sought independence from Georgia in the early 1990s, and the Georgians and the Russian Federation have been at odds over those two districts for some time. And then, of course, really since 2003, as Georgia had what was at the time called a Rose Revolution, in which the old Communist Party apparatchik Eduard Shevardnadze was ousted as president of Georgia. He himself was very pro-Russian, at least in the kind of cultural orientation. He had been, after all, the foreign minister of the Soviet Union back in the day. He was ousted in favor of a much younger American-educated, English-speaking politician named Mikhail Saakashvili. And Saakashvili, steered Georgia on a very clear course toward the West, toward membership in NATO, which is something Saakashvili very much desired, which is something that, strategists, particularly on the right in the United States, very much desired because it was seen as a scotch against Russian neo-imperial ambitions in the Caucasus. And that tension, I think, then came to a head with the Russia-Georgia war in 2008.
I see. So let's move on very quickly to, because I want to save time to talk about the very recent conflicts, let's move on to the relationship between Azerbaijan and Persia. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, this, again, is one of those long-standing cultural connections that is really not mirrored, I think, in contemporary political ways. But Azerbaijanis are traditionally of Shia Islam heritage, just like Iranians or Persians. Much of the sort of food ways and local folk culture in Azerbaijan itself would not be unfamiliar to many Persians, even though the Azerbaijani speak a Turkic language, it's very close to modern Turkish. While of course the Persians traditionally speak Farsi or another variety of that Indo-European language. It's also the case that today there are more Azerbaijanis, if we can use that term, that is Turkic-speaking Muslims of Shia religious background living in Iran than live in Azerbaijan. So there's a very powerful ethnic connection across that border.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how has that manifested itself in contemporary politics? Are they friendly now, the Azeris and the Iranians, or...?
Well, they certainly get along, but the twist in the story is that it turns out that the really friendly relationship with Iran in the South Caucasus is actually coming from Armenia. Mm-hmm. Armenians have a long, even though they're traditionally apostolic Christian by religion, have had a long cultural connection with Iran. And because of the strategic games that get played in the South Caucasus, the powerful relationship is now the Armenian-Iranian one. Azerbaijanis and Armenians have been at odds over a territorial dispute since the late 1980s, and so it's been difficult, I think, for the Azerbaijanis and the Iranians to become very friendly, mm-hmm. so long as Iran has been supporting Armenia. So you very, very complex strategic and diplomatic relations in that part of the world that mirror in some ways the complexities of culture and ethnicity.
Yeah, let me just ask a very open-ended question. What about all that oil? How does that play into it?
Well, it plays in. There's an interesting piece, I think, in the Washington Post or New York Times today about the $40 million in property that the president's family of Azerbaijan now owns in Dubai, including a whole set of condos owned by the 11-year-old son of the Azerbaijani president. You know,
do you think he has to? As I have a couple of young kids at home, do you think he has to clean up after himself in those places?
Yeah, well, the guy's got a lot of toys, yeah. So he needs an offshore storage facility for those toys. You know, Azerbaijan is really the only place in the Caucasus with significant oil. There's some oil reserves in Chechnya, of all places, but it's really the oil and gas coming from Azerbaijan has been the principal focus of talk about oil politics in the Caucasus over the last 20 years or so. It means that, you know, Azerbaijan itself has a great deal of pull, I think, in regional politics and is given a great deal of leeway from European powers and the United States on some basic issues like democracy and human rights. No one believes that Azerbaijan is anything close to a democracy. No one believes that they respect basic human rights. You really need to be an opposition politician in Azerbaijan to understand that. But it's the power of that they have wielded in international market has been perhaps disproportionate to their size or their strategic importance simply because of the oil that's available there. I'll say the other thing that has been in favor of Georgia and Azerbaijan over the last couple of decades, over the last decade in particular, and because many Americans often wonder, you know, why do we care about Azerbaijan? I get the oil, but, you know, what else is there? Why do we care about this tiny little country called Georgia, you know, fewer than 5 million people? Who cares? One of the key issues under the last administration and even under the Obama administration is actually overflight rights, the ability of American military aircraft to get to Central Asia and Afghanistan by flying through Georgian and Azerbaijani airspace. Mm-hmm. So once again, strategy comes to bear here.
Mm-hmm. No, it's very interesting. And then there's the whole issue of where to put the pipelines. We won't go into that right now. It's very complicated. I have a friend in the State Department who I think is compelled to spend all of his time thinking about that. I don't envy him.
that's right. Pipeline politics, I think, you know, it's incredibly important, can be very, very, very boring, but it is a critical part of the way in which this the talks is knit together and tied to Western security and energy.
Yeah, I wanted to sort of close by talking about three moments in which this system, such as it is, felt a sort of external punch or perturbation, as the physicists like to say. And those three moments are, and I just wanted you to characterize how things fell out or shook up. And the first one was the Bolshevik Revolution itself, and then the incorporation of these areas into the Soviet Union. And the second one is World War II, which is a very complicated thing. I never really know what to say about what happened in the Caucasus in World War II, particularly about the exile of the Chechens, I think it is. That's a very odd episode. And then, of course, there's the fall of the the falling apart of the Soviet Union and the wars that resulted from that. So why don't we begin just with a very brief characterization of what happens after the Bolshevik Revolution and how these areas were incorporated into the Soviet Union?
Yes, I mean, we think that the Bolshevik Revolution was one kind of event and suddenly everything changed. But, of course, that wasn't the way it worked out on the ground. The coming to power of the Bolsheviks in Russia itself, or at least in the old Russian imperial capitals, didn't have much effect on the Caucasus immediately, except that it prevented any attempt by local political figures in the Caucasus from staying together with something that might have been a Russian republic or a Russian liberal or democratic republic, which of course was destroyed once the Bolsheviks staged their coup and then come to power. In response to that, in the South Caucasus and to a degree in the North Caucasus, local political elites create their own republics. And so from 1918 to 1920, 21, depending on the area that we're talking about, you have independent states in the Caucasus. There's an independent Georgian Democratic Republic, an independent Armenia, and an independent Azerbaijan. The first experience of these places with actual self-governance. By 1921, all of those places that have been conquered by the Bolsheviks at the end of the Russian Civil War, and then they become part of the Soviet Union. But in the book, I tell the story of what happened to those local politicians, you know, Mensheviks and others, who created these kind of phantom republics, and then where they went afterwards. Very interesting story. Many of them end up in Paris, going to cocktail parties, trying to buttonhole people and call for, you know, a Western invasion to liberate the Georgians.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a Transcaucasia for a while, wasn't there? I'm sorry, I just can't remember this part of the book.
That's right. Very briefly, there was one that was created right after the Bolshevik Revolution that didn't last very long. It was an effort by the Azerbaijanis and Armenians to kind of cooperate, didn't last. And then there's a Transcaucasus republic that's created after 1921 by the Bolsheviks, but mm-hmm. that eventually gives way to these independent Soviet republics of Georgia, Armenia.
So let's go on then to talk about World War II, and this is something I really – always confuses me. So the Germans in 1940, the end of 42, is it 43, make it all the way to the mm-hmm. Caucasus, and then something happens they don't stay there very long, but something happens, and it is not to the benefit of several of these peoples.
That's exactly right. I mean, the Germans, along with many of their allies, including the Romanians, make it all the way to the Caucasus. And in fact, if you talk with older people in the North Caucasus now, they will remember, you know, Romanian soldiers and so on who came through their village. And it tends to be Romanians rather than Germans whom they remember. But the Germans certainly make it there. They make it to they never really managed to cross the Caucasus to the south. That was their strategic aim, to grab those oil facilities in Azerbaijan. That never really happens, primarily because of the defeat at Stalingrad, after which, of course, the German armies are pushed back to the west. But because the armies made it that far, because you actually had the memory of these independent republics that had existed before the Bolshevik Revolution, or at least a sort of flirtation with independence in the North Caucasus before the Bolshevik Revolution, many of the ethnic groups in that region come under the suspicion of Stalin and Beria and other Soviet leaders. And several ethnic groups are deported in part or wholesale in 1943 and 1944 by the Soviet authorities as punishment for their alleged collaboration with the Nazis. The most spectacular and most horrific, I suppose, of those deportations affects the Chechens, when virtually the entirety of the ethnic Chechen population in what we now call Chechnya is deported to Kazakhstan and other parts of Central Asia, and spends 15 or 20 years in exile. It's not until the end of the 1950s some of the Chechens are allowed to come back to their native republic. And it's that traumatic experience of exile that becomes, by the 1990s, one of the chief grievances, one of the chief beefs that the Chechen nation has against the Russian. Interestingly, the first independent president of Chechnya and leader of the Chechen uprising, Dzhokhar Dudayev, was actually born in exile. So that had a very visceral reality to many Chechens.
Yeah, that's very interesting, and I think it's forgotten. But let's actually go to that third perturbation, and that is the destruction of the Soviet Union and then the fallout that follows, which turns out to be – I mean, we think of – we, I don't know who we is, but I tend to think of the – collapse of the Soviet Union as remarkably peaceful, at least peaceful in the sense that I did expect more conflict than there was. But in fact, it wasn't hardly conflict-free in this area of the world. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
That's right. I mean, it was by and large a peaceful affair. Some of the great conflicts one might have expected, the great Russia-Ukraine war, thankfully never took place. But the Caucasus was by far the most violent region during the Soviet breakup. You had a whole series of small territorial wars that took place basically over the question of who gets to be independent. The Caucasus was divided not only into a series of Soviet republics, Georgia, Armenia, and so on, but those republics in turn were often subdivided into local autonomous republics or autonomous provinces, places called Abkhazia and South Ossetia and Nagorno-Karabakh, each themselves having their own kind of ethnic minority or ethnic designation with their own grievances against Georgians, against Azerbaijanis, or whatever republic they happen to live in. When those republics started declaring independence from the Soviet Union, those autonomous provinces and regions within the republic said, that's fine, we're going to declare independence from you too. So you had this whole series of cascading demands for independence wrapped up to a degree in Russia's desire to retain some kind of influence in the crumbling Caucasus. And the result in the late 80s and early 1990s was a series of really brutal territorial wars in places that are generally forgotten by all but a small handful of specialists, with the exception, of course, of Chechnya, the one territorial conflict inside Russia itself that garnered a great deal of attention over the 1990s. Two very, very brutal wars that the Russians fought there and wound down the last one, the second Chechen War, only last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they were remarkably brutal. I remember them well. Let's put aside the war over Nagorno-Karabakh and let's put aside for a second the Chechen War and talk a little bit about what I think is in many ways the sort of most interesting, and that is precisely because of the longstanding relationship between Georgia and Russia, and that is the Georgian wars over or concerning, or I don't know exactly what preposition to use there, over Abkhazia and Ossetia. Can you just talk a little bit about those?
Yeah, so this is, again, an example of those cascading independence demands. In the very early 1990s, two autonomous regions of Georgia, Abkhazia up in the northwest and South Ossetia in north-central Georgia, declared independence from Georgia not long after Georgia had declared independence from this crumbling country called the Soviet Union. At that stage, there was a great deal of support for Abkhaz and South Ossetian independence coming from just on the other side of the mountains, from the Circassians, who were kind of cousins of the Abkhaz, from the North Ossetians, who were the brothers of the South Ossetians living just on the other side of what had now become this international border between Russia and Georgia. Local Russian soldiers who were still stationed in Georgia at that time tended to side with the secessionists. They viewed the Georgians as being sort of overbearing, even genocidal fanatics who were intent on wiping out the Abkhaz as a people and wiping out the Ossetians as a people. That was at least their perspective at the time. And with Russian assistance, those secessionist entities essentially defeated the Georgian military, creating by 1993 a kind of de facto independent status of these tiny places, Abkhazia, South Ossetia. Abkhazia had about 150,000 people in it by the end of the war. South Ossetia had about 60, 70,000 people in it by the end of the war. And that was the situation all the way up to the summer of 2008. Georgians kept trying to negotiate. The international community created all these mechanisms through the UN and other international bodies to try to get these territorial conflicts resolved. But the secessionists had won on the battlefield, and of course they weren't going to back down on what they perceived as their hard-won independence. Independence is also extremely good if you want to engage in illicit crime, illicit trade and crime and so on. And plenty of that was going on in Abkhazia and South Ossetia, you know, human trafficking, hazelnut trafficking, copper wire trafficking, arms, you name it. Stuff was coming through those black holes. Georgia, in the summer of 2008, from the Georgian perspective, responding to a lot of provocations from the South Ossetians, decided to try to solve this by military force, to sort of rush into South Ossetia, grab control of the capital, and create a kind of fait accompli before either the South Ossetians or their Russian backers could respond. That was a great plan for about 12 hours. And then after that, it all went south. And so for the next 4.5 days, Russia was really sent packing as Russia invaded what everyone realized was Russian territory in South Ossetia, assisted the South Ossetians in pushing the Georgians back. And then the Georgians never managed to rush into Abkhazia, but Russia beefed up its military a representation in Abkhazia as well. And then not long after the defeat of Georgia in the second South Ossetian War, Russia recognized Abkhazia and South Ossetia as independent. So now there's a great deal of controversy about how to move forward. Russia, along with Venezuela and Nicaragua, Daniel Ortega kind of back on the scene, Abkhazia and South Ossetia are now recognized by, you know, at least three countries in the world as independent, and there's an Abkhaz, representation in Managua these days, I guess. So now it's a real conundrum, how do you actually proceed on this? It has some parallels with Kosovo, where the United States was very intent on getting countries to recognize Kosovo. Plenty of members of the European Union have not recognized Kosovo, but the United States and many of its friends and allies have. So you've got still this uncertain status.
Yeah. I don't know. I look at these things, and I guess one shouldn't say this, but what the hell? You know, I say kind of a plague on all their houses because there really are no good guys here. I mean, I know this. I studied the Nagorno-Karabakh War pretty intensively. I didn't follow this one as much. But, you know, they're really – it's hard to find people acting well anywhere in any of this business, at least as far as I could tell. And then the most bizarre part about it was the sudden – and I know we're almost out of time, but I want to hear you say a few things about this because I imagine it will be very enlightening – the sudden and newfound friendship between the – people of Georgia and the people of the United States. I had most people in the United States didn't even know where Georgia was. They thought it was a southern state.
Exactly right. And sort of, the Ray Charles thing about that. But, this is bizarre, I think, to many Americans. And when Dick Cheney during, was it John McCain? I can't remember. It was John McCain.
McCain. I think there's statues of McCain
who said, we're all Georgians now. There's actually a George W. Bush. There's a George W. Bush highway that leads from the airport to downtown Tbilisi. It's probably the only place named for George W. Bush in the world, outside of Dallas. But it is very bizarre, and I think that because Georgia was portrayed in the United States as this honorable flea standing up to the great Russian bear, that played very, very well in the United States initially. In the last year or so, I think we've come to understand the origins of the 2008 war in a much more nuanced way, the craziness of the Georgian government in launching this full-scale attack on South Ossetia. But you're right. Nobody emerged emerges from any of these conflicts with anything other than blood on their hands. And that's a great tragedy of this part of the world over the last 20 years.
It really is. Well, I can say this. We understand all these things better because of people like you, and you in particular.
Thank you.
So I would like to thank you very much for writing this book. And, you know, we've taken up a huge amount of your time, and I'm sorry about that. We're already, I can see by my clock, 6 minutes over, and your time is very valuable. What do you bill out at? About $300 an hour?
No, it's, I'll send you the bill.
Yeah, I have these corporate.
Thank you so much for having me. It's really been great.
Absolutely great. Let me ask you one final question, though. What are you working on now? What is your next project?
So the next project is a book about the city of Odessa in Ukraine, one of Europe's great Jewish cities, about a third Jewish by the 1940s, in this magnificent center of Jewish art, culture, literature, and so on, that is then destroyed, or at least the community is destroyed during the Holocaust. And so I'm sort of telling the story of the rise and fall of this quite magnificent city, and will be out in January of 2011. It's called Odessa: Genius and Death in a City of Dreams.
That's amazing because, you know, I really do believe it will be out in January of 2011, knowing how hard you work. I'm going to buy stock in you and Oxford University Press because
great, thank you. This is coming out with I should say this is with W.W. Norton.
Okay, I'm sorry about that. Sorry, Susan Ferber, if you're listening, I let that one slip through your fingers. You get him to write another one, okay? That'd be great. Well, anyway, I should tell our listeners that we've been talking and very enjoyably to Charles King about his new book, The Ghost of Freedom: A History of the Caucasus, which is terrific, and I encourage you to go out and buy. Charles, thanks very much for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much. It's been delightful.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Charles King, the author of The Ghost of Freedom, A History of the Caucasus. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.